You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive-compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. Hey guys, and welcome to episode 270 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I interview Laura Johnson. Laura is behind the Instagram account OCD Doodles, and I got her on to share her story. She shares her earliest experiences, existential and superstitious worries, as a kid being triggered by seeing a school shooting on TV and worrying of harm coming to her family, how her experience of OCD impacted her family as a child, contamination worries, relationship worries, drinking alcohol to self-medicate, seeking help, then taking medication, her treatment journey from getting the wrong type of therapy, then her negative experiences of working with a coach, finally getting therapy with a qualified therapist experienced in OCD, feeling guilty around harm OCD, parenting while dealing with OCD, and much, much more. It was great to finally get her on and for her to share her story with you guys. And thanks to NoCD for sponsoring this show. To find out more about NoCD and their therapy plans, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories or click the link in the episode description. So thank you to NoCD for supporting the show, and thank you to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Laura from OCD Doodles. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Stu. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So, as you know, it'd be good to hear your OCD story or otherwise.
Okie doke. Yeah, I was wondering how to start this because I usually start with, oh, I've had OCD since childhood, since I was 5 or 6. But there's actually a slightly earlier memory that I have that I often wonder whether it was an intrusive thought, an hallucination, or actually another worldly experience. I was 2.5, and I know I was 2.5 because we lived in a particular house and I moved before I turned 3. And one night I remember being in bed, and it's one of my earliest memories, and I screamed so loud because I turned to my side, and as far as I was aware, I saw this thing at the side of me that, I mean, I always laugh when I tell this story now because it sounds ridiculous. But and I saw what I would describe now as an abominable, I can't even say the word, snowman, like a big furry monster thing at the side of me. And I screamed, and my dad remembers it. He said he thought somebody had got in the house and got me. And he ran through to my bedroom and he sat on the side of the bed with me. And I remember looking back at my bed and I could still see this thing. Mm. Now, looking back, knowing now that I have OCD, and I wonder whether that was one of my very first intrusive thoughts or whether I was ill and it was, you know, I had an infection and I just had an hallucination as a kid. But I think that from that stemmed this fear of the unknown. And I mean, as a scientist, I'd say I'd had an hallucination because it was so vivid.
Yeah.
And I remember it so clearly still. I wonder if that stemmed this fear of existence and what it means. And that's what really affected me in my early childhood, as well as this fear of losing family members. So now I wonder whether that was the start of my OCD story or something that triggered something, you know, later on that then eventually became OCD. When I was about 5 or 6, I seem to remember being overly concerned about keeping my mum safe, keeping myself safe, feeling very, very responsible for that. And, you know, the classic game that kids play of not standing on the cracks that we hear a lot of. I remember playing that but being genuinely frightened that if I did not stick to the parts of the pavement that weren't cracks, that, you know, I was going to cause some serious harm. And I used to walk in certain ways. I'd go up steps in certain numbers. And I'd be worried about meteorites and existential threats on an evening, unable to sleep for it. And that's when I think it really started to pick up and start to snowball. And then in primary school, I remember the Dunblane shooting. That really affected me as well. And so I started getting very vivid graphic images of gunmen and harm coming to family. And I was really, really preoccupied with it. It would affect my sleep. But nobody knew because it was hidden. And it, you know, I grew up in quite an anxious family as well. So it was the norm. And then what I would say was an OCD episode that really got me was I had an obsession with alcohol and cigarettes, and my parents either smoking or drinking and harm coming to them when I was about maybe 10 years old, and to the point where I wouldn't walk down the alcohol aisle in the supermarket. My mum wanted to go out every Friday night, not Friday night, sorry. That was my night, Friday night. Every Wednesday night with her pals. But to me, she was going to a poison factory and she was just poisoning herself, and these people were leading her astray, and I had to do everything in my power to stop it. So I would scream down the phone when her friends called, trying to put them off going out with her. I wouldn't go down the alcohol aisle in the supermarkets. I'd try and block my parents from going on in the duty-free on the ferries. You know, if there was alcohol in the house, I'd tip it down the sink. So it was a lot of avoidance and trying to control other people, but not because I wanted to, because I was getting intrusive thoughts of harm coming to people, and I felt it was absolutely my responsibility to stop that if I could. So, yeah, that was and that ended with me writing to the Prime Minister and asking him to ban smoking, and me going into my friend's mum's house and asking where she kept her cigarettes and getting them all and going to the top window and ripping them all up and throwing them out of the window, which wasn't in my character. You know, it seemed to be a big contradiction to who I was. I was a well-behaved kid at school. I didn't want to be behaving like that, but I felt I had no choice. I felt it was the only way and it was my responsibility. But, you know, I guess to my parents, I just looked like I was going through a bit of a phase, and that it maybe wasn't affecting me as much as I knew it was. So, yeah, that I would say was my first big episode, you know, that I can look back on now and say, oh, that's why I behaved that way. But obviously I had no idea that it was related to OCD. And then I remember doing my exams at primary school and them really getting to me and me wanting to, you know, really preoccupied with not making mistakes at a very young age and feeling that there would be consequences that maybe other kids didn't feel there would be. And then so at high school, when I moved to high school, I enjoyed school, but I do remember having thoughts about gunmen storming the building, and I used to get quite worried about or preoccupied with knowing where my escape routes were, which, you know, I just, again, it was all in my head. There was nothing maybe visible on the outside other than me looking like a worrier maybe in certain situations. But I was absolutely terrified of failing at school. I was very preoccupied with my appearance, and recently I've just been diagnosed with BDD, actually, so that I can look back and maybe see that running through my life as well now. What else? Yeah, so at school it was really lack of sleep, not wanting to get up on a morning, not wanting to face the day, knowing I'd be hit with a lot of intrusive thoughts that I didn't really understand and I couldn't articulate. I just thought it was normal, you know. Well, I don't like to use that word, but I know everybody gets intrusive thoughts, but I felt that there was something going on for me that I couldn't see in other people. You know, I'd say things at school and people were like, Laura, that's ridiculous. You know, and I'd think, well, no, it's not. And that's been something throughout my life. I've just felt like this walking contradiction, and you know, people just didn't understand. I felt very, very misunderstood. So, yeah, a lot of rumination, a lot of reassurance seeking at school, and then social media came about and that sort of exacerbated all that, or it gave me a way to seek reassurance easier from my peers as well, not just whilst I was at school, but till 4 in the morning, you know, so I'd be up late at night on MSN Messenger. Not really knowing at the time, but seeking reassurance about my appearance and what I'd done that day at school, things like that. And then it came to my GCSEs, which you take in England when you're 15, 16. And again, very good at school, you know, well behaved, worked really hard, probably would have said I was top of the class, I was expected to do really well, found that an awful lot of pressure. Took my GCSEs, thought I'd failed, really thought, and to the point where I got myself a place at another school because I thought I can't go back and face my teachers. I've done really, really badly. And just unwanted thoughts about what my future might look like if I did really badly, what people would think about me. And yeah, I passed with, you know, I did really well. I think I got some top marks in country, which people, you know, I'd say to people, oh, I really think I failed. I think I failed. And people, and I'd seek that reassurance, and I must have been quite annoying, really, because, you know, people could see I'd probably done well, but I just could not see it at all. And it was a genuine fear. And then I moved to university. I had contamination fears at school, but because I lived at home, I was within my own bubble of contamination, if you like. And when I moved out of that and I started living with people, that's when I really started noticing contamination fears coming forward, and harm fears about getting to university safe. And for the first couple of years, I didn't do too bad. I was getting to university, sitting in lecture theatres, doing the work. And then about third year, it really hit me and I just couldn't get out of bed. For mentally checking my route to work, to the lectures, I felt a lot of guilt, shame. I remember saying it felt like there was a physical force holding me down. That, you know, and now I know that I was experiencing intrusive thoughts and I was going over situations that haven't yet happened to try and make them play out perfectly in my mind so that I'd get to the lecture theatre safe. If I got to the lecture theatre, I'd be so preoccupied with like bodily functions, worrying about my stomach rumbling, I couldn't concentrate. So it was just easier to avoid. So I stayed in bed most mornings, tried to catch up with lecture notes that my friends would bring for me. And there was a lot of guilt and shame around that because, again, it went completely against my character. You know, I enjoyed learning. I've always loved learning. I wanted to be in those lecture theatres. I wanted to be doing well. I wanted to be soaking up all that information. And, you know, I wanted a degree. And I pretty much taught myself in my third and fourth years at university. And I felt a real disconnect from the people around me. I mean, I loved the lasses that I ended up living with. You know, they were great. And gosh, I look back and think, well, my mind probably distorts it a bit because I actually had a bit of a chat with them last night. And I said, you know, from an external point of view, could you see it? And they said, all we could really see, Laura, was that in the kitchen you liked to have a certain cup and a certain knife and fork and you washed up with cold water in your hand, you know, to feel for dirt and things like that. But they just thought I had a few quirks. And so from the outside, that's how it looked when I know I was sort of mentally tortured inside now, but again, didn't have that explanation. I didn't have a diagnosis. I thought I was the one that, you know, that my beliefs were the norm, but you know, I couldn't understand why other people were behaving the way they were when there were so many threats around us. And but again, I couldn't articulate it. So then I got my first boyfriend towards the end of uni, and that didn't go well because we all know about relationship OCD. And yeah, looking back at that, the poor guy, it was too much. And I won't go into detail, but I just was really concerned that something was going on when it probably wasn't, constantly seeking reassurance. And yeah, that was enough for, well, we broke up, which was fine. You know, it wasn't meant to be anyway. But at that point, I lost my great nan as well. And I really started feeling quite depressed. And that's when I went to ask for help. And I said, ah, there is something. I don't know what it is, but there's something not quite right. So I went to the doctors and I had some counselling, therapy. It certainly wasn't ERP. Nobody mentioned OCD to me, although friends had joked about it in the past because, you know, I did like to be clean. I did like things a certain way, and that's what I thought OCD was. But then if you'd have walked into my bedroom at times, it was an absolute tip. There were pans of food under the bed because I couldn't bring myself to go clean them because I didn't want to touch them. So I thought, well, if I've got OCD, everything would be pristine and I'd just like things all, you know, the classic stereotype. I was so ignorant to what OCD was. And with people joking about it as well, I thought, well, it's a non-disorder, you know, it's not something that had even crossed my mind would be causing anything like what I was going through. So I went to the doctor and they said, we think you're clinically depressed, have some fluoxetine. I took that. I felt quite good actually on that, but I didn't, it wasn't a cure, you know. And I maybe felt less depressed, but I could still sense there was something in the background that hadn't been dealt with. And, you know, my friend said as well, who I live with, that I'd started to become nocturnal. You know, I wanted to sleep through the day, not go to my lectures, block out all those images of harm coming to people, myself. And I just wanted to go out drinking. I wanted to be with my pals. I just wanted some freedom. I wanted to escape all those intrusive thoughts, escape myself in a way, escape all the restraints I put on myself, how I thought I should behave. So alcohol was, ironically, something that I turned to self-medicate even after having that obsession with it as a young kid. So that brought a lot of shame and guilt with it as well, because I thought, well, hang on a minute, I really don't want to be drinking. It's not something that I personally want to do, but it was the only thing that would give me some temporary relief. And then obviously the next day OCD would come back much harder. But I didn't realise it at the time. So, I finished uni. I managed to get a degree. Was really gutted that I didn't get the first that I felt I was capable of if I felt capable of going to my lectures and having a routine. And that's something that stuck with me for a while, feeling like, not that getting any other grade has been a failure, but I, like my friend said, I'm my own worst critic, or the OCD is your own worst critic. It never let me live it down. And I tried to get a job as a clinical biochemist in Scotland, and I went to the interview and they said, what's your biggest achievement? And my answer was well, I managed to get a 2-1 degree whilst battling clinical depression. Totally naive to how I'd be judged, or which I shouldn't have been judged. But you know, that, and I was just being genuinely honest. And obviously, I didn't get the job. I'm not sure I should say this really, but I was told later that did have an impact on me. Not getting it. I was the only undergraduate with an interview, and I'd worked really, really hard to get myself into a position through all that, where I would be competing with people with PhDs, because I'd done a lot of research into the job. And so I was gutted, and I really hit a low, and I moved back home to Leeds. I went to uni in Edinburgh, so I moved back to Leeds. Yeah, for a few months, I seem to remember being quite down, not really knowing what I'd do. But like, I enjoyed learning. I'd always made this pact with myself that I wouldn't give up, no matter how, because I wasn't aware of what I was going through. But I knew that making big decisions whilst I was particularly poorly with it, whatever it was, wasn't a good idea. So I'd always decided that I'd just go for things and worry about it later. So I applied for a PhD. All the deadlines had passed, but I emailed somebody at Leeds and I said, you know, I'm really interested in science. I want to do this. And later I learned actually a lot of people with OCD, I think, go into philosophy degrees. So I did this PhD and I was living at home with my parents. But I was finding it increasingly hard to get out of the house and get to work again because I was frightened for my safety. I was laying in bed thinking about how I would get there, you know, again, going through my route, trying to be certain that I'd get there safe. And then again, when I got to the lab, you know, it was a lot of checking work, checking, writing, deleting, not really getting very far, not fulfilling my potential again, which used to really upset me. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't do it. You know, I was there and I was working and I was doing my best, but I knew that something was holding me back. And so, yeah, things like sitting in seminars again. And as soon as I had to get up to speak, you know, give a presentation on my work, I'd just get thoughts of gunmen entering the building. And so I'd be presenting and I'd be thinking, why am I thinking about, you know, and a lot of shame came with that. Does this make me a sick person? Why, you know, I'm presenting about a blooming protein. Why am I thinking about gunmen? Do I want people to be hurt? Am I, is this a premonition? Is this a sign of things to come? How do I stop it? What do I do? And so my anxiety before giving presentations would be high. And I'd force myself to get up and give them. I mean, I don't know what it looked like from the outside. I know I've probably got it now. I get this rash that just like kind of rises on my neck and on my face. I remember one of the professors actually saying to me, you know, Laura, maybe you should just wear like a neck scarf or something, you know, and I look back and I think, no. And I'm quite proud of myself for embracing that in a way and still doing it. But I mean, as it just got harder and harder as I went on, and the OCD was still untreated and I didn't know what it was. I was still drinking quite a lot, to not during the day. I mainly, you know, I'd go out and I'd have far too much from what my body could handle, and I'd either black out or I'd end up in situations that I didn't want to be in, and end up quite frightened. And then obviously the doubt that comes the next day with where you've been, what have you done, who are you with, would frighten me. And then I started my PhD in 2008, and in 2010 I met my husband. Had a couple of failed relationships before that, again probably influenced by the OCD. And we moved in together in 2011. I finished my PhD in 2012. I learned to drive in 2013. We bought a house, we got engaged. And then in 2014, so a lot happened in a very short space of time, and with a lot of uncertainty as well. I was terrified to learn to drive. That affected me a lot. And then my husband had an accident in 2014, where he was pushed over a wall by a friend on a bit of a drunken night out. And one of our friends was left paralysed from the waist down, and my husband, who fell with him, walked away, but he had a rotator cuff repair that he needed doing, and you know, he fully recovered, but our friend was left paralysed. And I got in the car that night. I'd only just learnt to drive, and it was just terrifying. and I drove to Halifax, which I don't know how many miles away that is from Leeds, but it required a motorway journey, let's put it that way. And I was trembling, and the reason I mention it is because I think this was the start of an episode of harm OCD, or I don't know, I call it harm OCD. You know, I've seen graphic images of harm coming to other people, but that I'd caused indirectly by being neglectful. And in 2015 as well, we got married and we went on our honeymoon, and we were involved in an earthquake in Borneo. I'm not a great flyer. I'd forced myself to go on the honeymoon with no expectation of really enjoying it, just that I knew I'd regret it if I didn't go. So I went. We were in an earthquake, and that we'd been on this Via Ferrata up Mount Kinabalu in Borneo 10 days prior to the earthquake. And on the day of the earthquake, the people that died were the people that had been on the Via Ferrata, and they were all 12-year-old school children.
That's okay.
So that, and I think that those couple of years were what really sparked this absolute need to keep people safe, and this guilt that came with it as well. You know, that should have been me, but then feeling guilty for feeling that should have been me. You know, because obviously I've got a family that I love dearly, and that I couldn't protect those children, and that, you know, we'd caused it by going to Borneo, and you know, things like, because I don't think they'd had an earthquake for about 20 years. So I'd often see things as signs and my fault. I remember 9/11 actually. I remember walking home from school the day that happened. And the reason I remember it, I mean, it was probably a compulsion that I did every day coming home from school, but I just remember it because it so happened to be on 9/11. And I remember thinking to myself, if you don't dodge this tree branch, something really, really terrible is going to happen. And I mean, I remember this tree branch. I'm sure I probably did it every day walking home. And I can't remember where I dodged or ducked under it, but it, to my mind, I'd done the wrong thing. And I got home and I saw on the television that 9/11 had happened. And I remember just being absolutely convinced that I had something to do with it. And then, you know, I'd think, well, Laurie, you're not special. You know, who do you think you are thinking this way? But my mind was really quite convincing. And so I'd go back and forth between, you're a terrible person, you think you're special, don't be so arrogant, you know, that kind of thing. And feeling responsible for things that had happened in the media when, I mean, rationally, I know that I had absolutely nothing to do with them, but it's the what if, isn't it? It's that not point, well, there's not even a chance, but you know, that when your mind presents it to you, you've got OCD and it's untreated, you go with it, and who's to say that it's not real? You know, that's how I used to think. So yeah, that my husband's accident and a few other things really quite got to me, and so that's when I sought help again. I thought, no, there's something going on. And I don't believe it's I say just depression, but I don't mean it in that way. But, yeah, you know, it doesn't add up. So I went back to the doctors and I went on the IAPT waiting list for treatment. And they said it would be about, I think it was 4 to 6 months, in which time I got pregnant. And I didn't realise that because I was pregnant, I probably could have speeded that, you know, me seeing somebody up. But I eventually saw somebody, and he was a really great guy. He wasn't an ERP specialist, but he said, you know, this really sounds like OCD. And I just burst into tears, and it was just a light bulb, because what I'd heard about OCD, I somewhat, you know, people had joked I had it in the past, but I didn't know what it was. And prior to that, actually, I remember something. Before I could have the treatment, I was asked to go to 3 seminars, you know, where they tell you how the basics on dealing with your emotions, and, you know, to see if you actually need further treatment, or if those 3 seminars will give you enough information to go on your way. And I remember this lad putting his hand up and saying, I suffer with OCD. And then that's all I remember him saying, but he did go on to say some other things. And I remember sitting in front of him, a few rows in front. I remember thinking, and I feel quite ashamed to say this, but I think it's really important in the way, I remember thinking, OCD, what's he doing here? I'm suffering from clinical depression and something, do you know? And that is how I thought. And I'm not blaming anybody else, but in part, the role of the media and how OCD is joked about, how it's trivialised, definitely played a hand in how I thought about OCD. But I don't want to sound like I'm passing on responsibility, but I I'm so ashamed, or I still feel a lot of shame for thinking that way about this poor guy who was, now I know, probably really, really suffering. And I think in a way that moment is what drives in part the advocacy that I want to do. Anyway, back to my story. So I was pregnant. I saw this therapist, told me it was likely OCD. I think we did one exposure one exposure in the office where I had to write down on a piece of paper that I was going to die in a terrorist attack. Which I couldn't even say out loud at the time, you know. And then I was on my merry way again with, I didn't take any antidepressants then because I had this thought that I was going to poison my baby and that, you know, it just wasn't even an option for me, it felt at the time. And I was still working at the time, but struggling to get into work. I mean, I don't think I was getting into work till about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, maybe every day. And I always think it's quite ironic that I worked in a lab that worked on viruses, and I worked in a containment level 3 virus lab, which for people who think OCD is just about fear of bacteria, and which I know it can be, and that's serious, but it always makes me, you know, think, wow, how wrong I was. I was back then to think that's what OCD was. But anyway, I worked in this virus lab, and I used to hide in there. You know, I'd find some comfort with the viruses, and I'd go hide in this virus lab just so that I didn't have to face my my colleagues when I got there and face the questions of, oh, hi Laura, how are you? Well-meaning comments, you know, and questions. So yeah, I was struggling to get to work. I told my boss, I mean, I was going between it being depression, premenstrual syndrome, bipolar was mentioned at one point to me. You know, when I was back at uni, one of my friends sat me down and said, Laura, have you ever thought you might have bipolar disorder? And to be honest, that seemed to fit more because I was so up and down. But I think that was more to do with my cycle rather than, I'm not diagnosed with bipolar, let's put it that way. So, yeah, I became a mum. I went on maternity leave. So I was in the house, and that's when thoughts of going to soft plays and gunmen again coming in, graphic images of harm coming to my child. And I got to a point where I just didn't want to leave the house. I was worried about contamination fears. I was worried about people coming in my house and making food for my child and then poisoning it. So everything was on me. I had to wash everything. I had to make their food. I breastfed I wanted to breastfeed, but there were definitely intrusive thoughts around poison being put in formula milk. And even when I was going through a hard time, I was suffering with some gallbladder attacks and in and out of A&E. And my mum said, you know, Laura, you need to give yourself a break. Just let us give my daughter some formula milk. And I just couldn't. I'd rather have been on my deathbed and fed her. You know, I couldn't. Yeah. I just couldn't do it. And anything that, you know, touched the floor, anything, couldn't go near her mouth. And that all came to a head when we were on a Centre Parks holiday with my mother-in-law, and, you know, I tried to hide it from my extended family. I broke down. I think a teether had been put in the bottom of a pram, in the little basket at the bottom of the pram, and maybe somebody had got it out and went to wash it maybe and gave it to my daughter. But I just stopped. And that was around when my daughter was 1 year old. And I just got in the shower. Well, I cried, I screamed, I kicked, you know, I just had a breakdown. I just lost it. And I had to get in the shower, and that's when I realised that I was showering to decontaminate myself of shame and guilt. And I didn't know what else to do. And I just wanted to be mentally and physically clean. And I remember speaking to my mother-in-law, and we agreed I needed to get some help, more help. So that's when I'd say I was probably at my most desperate, and I went online to see if anybody else felt the same, because I'd never met anybody with OCD other than the poor lad in the seminar who I'd written off as, you know, unfortunately, not proud to say it. That's when I found an unqualified coach online. But I thought I'd tried the therapists, you know, I thought I'd been down that route. And I agreed to treatment, coaching, but to my mind it was pushed as treatment because it was exposures. It was unethical. At the time, I thought I was getting better and I was all for this treatment. You know, I was really pushing it on social media and, again, something I regret, but it's part of my journey and, you know, it happened and I was desperate. And it was actually a post by Kimberly Quinlan that made me wake up and see what was happening. I think I was about 9 months into this treatment. I spent a lot of my redundancy money because by this point I'd decided to take redundancy. I mean, work was really difficult. I couldn't get there. I couldn't get back. I had a baby. That was after maternity leave. And I took the decision. I mean, even up to that point, I'd been pushing to get a fellowship and get my own lab. And I'd made that pact with myself to just keep going, do it regardless and just see what happens. But I just had to admit that I wasn't well, really wasn't well, and I needed something had to give. Anyway, I started this so-called treatment. It wasn't good. I won't say too much about it, but... I wished I'd have reached out to a charity or, but this it was all over social media. There were so many followers. So I went with it. And it ended up, I thought it was working at first, but it ended up doing more harm than good long term. And that's when I decided that, when I saw this post by Kimberly Quinlan, I decided I needed out because what I was liking on social media was being policed and it was just a bad situation that, I stepped back and I could see it at that point, thankfully. So I got myself out of that situation, didn't spend any more money on that, started following people like yourself, Kimberly, the American therapists that are just amazing that share all these little nuggets of wisdom. And I started to get this picture of what OCD treatment should actually look like. I was under the perinatal service as well when I got pregnant with my son in 20. So I stopped the unethical treatment in 2018 and I got pregnant in February 2019. And so I was under the perinatal service and I saw another psychotherapist, but again, somebody that wasn't an OCD specialist. And then I saw another psychotherapist who was really great. And I've learned a lot from all these different therapists, but it wasn't a structured course of ERP. And so I was starting to, I was starting to think I was a failure. Why is it not working for me? You know, I'm going through the right channels now. Surely I should be getting better. And then I called OCD Action. And they pointed me in the direction of the OCD specialists and the CADAP PAC service at the Maudsley. And, yeah, now I'm on, session 4 or 5, and I think I start my behavioural treatment this week. Nice. So I'm not recovered. I'm definitely recovering. I've learned an awful lot from yourself, podcasts, the people that are qualified as well that put things online, and the advocates that, are ethical. And yeah, so at the minute, I'm there. I think that brings me up to date. Sorry if that took an awful long time.
No, it was.
I'm trying not to forget anything, and there's always that doubt, is that OCD? Is that not OCD? That situation you've described, Laura, is that really? I still get all that.
Yeah.
But really what I want to tackle is these graphic harm thoughts and around my children and handling those now. And that's where I'm at.
No, thank you for sharing. And my take on it is it doesn't matter if it's OCD or not. If you're suffering, you're deserving and worthy of treatment, and that's it. You know, we get so stuck on whether it's OCD or not. Is the person suffering? That's all that matters. Yeah. Okay, no, thank you so much for being open and going into detail. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
So I got a few questions. So because we'll just, if okay, we'll pick up on the unethical coaching for a second, as that was quite near the end. So you, I do remember what Kimberly posted on her Instagram stories, actually. That sticks out in my head too. A couple of questions. So one was, you said there about your posts you were liking were being policed. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so I'd liked Kimberly's post, and to be honest, I've not actually even watched it. Sorry, Kimberly, if you're listening. You know, I'd seen a picture of Kimberly. I was like, post, support it. I'll probably go back to it later and listen to it. And I got this phone call asking why I'd liked this particular post from this person. And that was the moment where I was like, that's not right.
No.
That's not right. This is not right. And whether that person's intentions were on, you know, I don't want to start.
There were clear boundaries that were being crossed.
Yeah, exactly. From therapy I'd had in the past, even though it wasn't ERP that I'd had, you know, there are ethical codes for a reason. And I think I'd got so disillusioned with therapy and me not getting better that even as a scientist, that, you know, I knew about ethics and things like that. I'd thrown all that in my head, just wanted something different.
Yeah, you were desperate.
I was desperate and I was vulnerable as well. But the thing that it lacked was compassion and boundaries. And, you know, I was thrown into exposures that were, I still feel quite traumatized by. Okay. There was, you know, I was a mum with two young kids. Well, I had one kid at the time. And maybe these were exposures that might have been done with a qualified therapist, but I didn't know how to process them. I hadn't got the framework around me to, you know, to process them in a way that I presume was needed. I was doing things like doing exposures in town and then getting in my car and driving, which... And having, you know, migraines to the point where I could only see tunnel vision. I was that stressed, you know, and really, which maybe is my, you know, I don't want to put the blame on anybody, but I was in a bad way and I was being put on a pedestal as a recovery story as well and flaunted as one. And obviously I have the doctor title. So that was being put on post. I asked for all that to be removed. And it just came with a lot of shame because I'd been putting this person out there as well. And maybe, you know, I'm not here to tell anybody what to do. I can only tell you what happened to me. Yeah. And it's now part of my story, you know, and it drives me like you would not believe to make sure that people know that the charities are there, to know that NoCD are there, they're qualified therapists, to know that the NHS are there and that there are qualified OCD specialists. I know that there's a lot to be done to get the right treatment into people's hands, but the answer isn't necessarily finding somebody unqualified online.
I agree. Well, yeah. And I think also a few years ago, there was far less therapists on social media and writing blog posts and having a web presence. Whereas now they're kind of everywhere, which I think is a good thing because people don't feel like they need to go down these other routes because therapists are more visible. And I also agree with what you said, like go to where the information is held. And what I mean by that is the charities, like you said, they're going to know the right routes. Also, like in the States or somewhere, you could go to a big clinic like Rogers and just say, do you know any in my area? So go to places that are credible and ask for referrals. And again, in the UK, you can go to the NHS, you may still go down the wrong, you'll get a therapist, and it may be the wrong therapy, as you've said. But with the NICE guidelines in the UK, you can say, no, hang on a minute. It says I need CBT and ERP. So thank you, but please find me someone else who does this, because this is the government guidelines, or the NICE guidelines. And I don't blame you. People are desperate. You do what you need to take care of yourself. And some of these coaches, I guess, prey on that a bit.
And there's a lot of money to be made from it, as well. And, you know, it was relatively cheap when I was with them, but now it's a lot more expensive, and I spent a lot of my, not that it's all about money, but it costs.
And if it didn't work, it's even
well, even worse. It did more damage than I think than good. Yeah. So I mean, I've been through 4 psychotherapists, a couple of university counsellors, an unqualified person, and then it was when I called OCD Action that I got the information that I needed, and the NICE guidelines, and and now I'm with and it's not just an OCD specialist I'm with; it's an OCD specialist that specialises in treating parents as well. Okay. So you know that I didn't know that they existed,
and this is with the Maudsley Hospital.
That's with the Maudsley. Nice.
They know their stuff.
They do know their stuff, and the professionalism, the structure, that is what. And I'm like, that's what therapy should look like. But the Next Steps service that OCD Action offered me was really, really great, because they've been by my side throughout my last round of therapy and this therapy, and you know, checking that what was happening was ERP. And whilst I had a great therapist last time, in terms of, you know, he was a really great guy, and I learned a lot from him, it wasn't a structured course of ERP. And OCD Action made me realise that, and that's when I went, you know, onto the Maudsley. So they've been absolutely great.
No, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. Okay, so yeah, really, really interested to hear how it works for you at the Maudsley and how you progress. I'm sure you're going to put it on your Instagram page or what you want to share. So I guess let's go right back to the beginning, if okay. When you said you were about 3, is that right? Where you kind of saw this abominable snowman or Bigfoot or Sasquatch, whatever you want to call it. I guess it makes sense that you said it was more of a hallucination, because it wasn't, there might be something there. It was, there's something there. That's what it sounds like to me. Is that?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I still can picture it vividly. Okay. But then, you know, knowing I have OCD and knowing how you can go over and over something so much in your mind, it can change. But having my dad's account of what happened as well, I mean, my dad said there was nothing there. Okay. You know, there wasn't actually anything there, but I could see it. And my memory of it, I mean, I was younger than 3, I was about 2.5, I think.
Wow. So for it to sear in your brain like that, it's quite traumatic.
Yeah. And I just wonder if that was actually the start of
the breaking point.
Such a young age. I think it started to take hold maybe 10, 11.
Okay.
And I started realizing that, we were mortal, you know. I knew my parents could be harmed earlier than that, but definitely started thinking about, you know, family members dying around that age.
Yeah. And when did your parents kind of catch on to something that was quite not right, so to speak?
I'm not sure they did, to be honest. Just because... Well, I was so well behaved at school, and I think I can't speak for them, but I get the impression they maybe thought that it was just my release at home. You know, I was a kid, I was going to be cheeky at times, I was going to say things, I was just going to go through phases maybe, and it, you know, and actually they were probably doing exposure therapy without even realizing it, you know, sending me back to bed whilst I was terrified a meteorite was going to hit the, you know, and I was having to lay there and not, you know, they were really loving parents. And I think if they'd have known what was wrong, they'd have absolutely taken me for help. But a lot of my compulsions were either avoidance or rumination, and internal reassurance. You know, it wasn't things like, you know, the classic, I say classic, you know, I know
it's checking, washing,
checking, things that praying. People could see. I did used to pray, but I did it in my head at night, and I had to say names in a certain way, in a certain order, and if I didn't get them in the right order, I had to start again, or if I felt like I'd not said it right or I'd not meant it, I'd go over and over and over this, the Lord's Prayer. And I'd say my Lord's Prayer, and I'd end with, dear Lord, please protect my mum, my dad, my sister, my nan, my grandma, my granddad, you know, and my aunties, my uncles, my cousins, and everybody less fortunate than myself in this world. And that's what I used to say, and I remember it still now. And yeah, things like, I remember the news really affecting me, you know, seeing these adverts on the telly about, you know, children starving in other countries. I was very, very sensitive to things like that, feeling like I was responsible or I had to do something, whether it was saying something in my head, whether it was, you know, really disagreeing with something in my head and disagreeing with it strongly, and making sure I did disagree with it, checking my feelings when I saw certain things. There was a whole host of compulsive behaviour going on. But I was performing well at school, you know. I was to the outside.
Yeah, you went under the radar.
My flatmate said there wasn't really much, Laura. We just thought you were you, and you were a bit quirky. You just didn't want to go to uni, probably. You know, I probably looked really lazy. Because I used to try and laugh at stuff as well. You know, I used to try and laugh things off and try and cover stuff up. And I didn't understand it myself.
Mm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, good points. Okay, well, look, so thank you for sharing your story. And, you know, that story has led you to create OCD Doodles, which many people listening will probably come across your work. You know, what is OCD Doodles?
So, well, it was born in my second pregnancy. I was waiting for... I wasn't waiting for a call from the hospital. I was trying not to call the hospital back to try and get a blood test result.
Okay.
And I just thought, I've had enough with this now. I need to put this down on paper, and I need to distance myself from it in some way that, you know, I can look back on it and see how irrational it is. And I also, to begin with, it was about me. You know, it was about me holding myself accountable. And then I started thinking about all those people like me who went undiagnosed for so long, and I was thinking, do you know what, if I had these doodles on social media and I'd have seen something like this back then, I'd have got help so much faster. I'd have felt part of a community. I'd have maybe been directed towards qualified people rather than falling for, you know, back then. Yeah, and so really it was a mixture of doing something for myself to aid with my recovery, and, you know, putting this out there and not letting the OCD silence me, and letting people know. I mean, there are other advocates out there doing just, you know, the same, doing great jobs, but I just wanted to use what my thing was, really, which was doodling at the time, to help that, you know, that advocacy work that you all do.
Yeah, it's clearly, I enjoy them. I enjoy how you clearly lay out things like concepts and thought processes. And I think it's brilliant. And it clearly resonates with people, because you've hit whatever it is, 25,000 nearly.
Yeah.
28.
So I think this, so yeah, I mean, I do what I can when I can. I was saying this earlier. Yeah, I've still got one child at home with me, and my daughter's at school. But And so I put out what I can when I can. But that's, you know, I'm a bit frustrated at the minute. There's so much I want to do with it. You know, I've had to close my shop and things like that. But I'm in touch with a lot of therapists in America, and, you know, they've all been really great, taking on board my OCD cycle doodle. And so, there's a lot of connections I want to make. I want to come to some of the conferences, but at the minute, I'm mum first and foremost at home, and then I doodle sort of in the dark hours. As I read, because I've read a lot of self-help books, and, you know, John Hirschfield's been a big influencer of mine, Kimberly Quinlan's posts, yourself, Chrissy Hodges, Catherine Benfield, so many people have influenced, you know, I'm so grateful to them. So, yeah, just to be alongside you guys now is just amazing. But frustrating, because there's so much I want to do that, you know, I haven't had a chance to do yet. But there's time, you know, one step at a time, baby steps. It's nice that I've got it whilst I go through, you know, real specialist treatment as well, because I will document what I can as I go through it.
I agree. I think it will make your posts more potent and sort of relatable, because you're going through what a lot of people are right now.
I hope so.
Yeah, well, I'll put the link to your Instagram page or account in the show notes, so definitely check it out if anyone's not familiar with your work. Okay, so words of hope for people with OCD.
Words of hope. Can I share the one thing that gave me a lot of hope? I saw some videos by Dr. Jonathan Grayson on, I think it was on the Peace of Mind Foundation YouTube channel, and he said something that really resonated with me. And he said the same, in so many words, he said, the same question lies at the core of both creativity and OCD. What if? And that has just been something that I've held on to for whilst I've been doing OCD doodles, because I think you can get so bogged down in the darkness of it. And I like to remind myself of, you know, the bookshelf that John Hirschfield has in his Mindfulness for OCD workbook. We can access those dark thoughts, but there's also, you know, the really bright thoughts on the other side of the bookshelf that the OCD brain can pick up on as well. And I remind myself of that often. In that whilst it is awful to suffer from OCD, if there is anything to be taken from it, in my personal opinion, it is that a lot of the people that I meet are extremely creative and they've got something amazing to give. Even if it's not down the route of, you know, like I thought, oh, I'll do my GCSEs, I'll do my PhD, I'll become a scientist, I'll do this. Never in a million years did I think I'd be doing OCD doodles and potentially putting them into a book eventually, hopefully. And, you know, it's completely off the path that I thought I had for myself. So I think they'd be my words of hope, would be that, you know, you have another side to these thoughts that, if harnessed, can be really quite something and make a difference.
Yeah,
I really like that. And also there are OCD specialists out there that, you know, and a lot of self-help resources.
Yeah, nice. And your 20-year-old self, you can pick up the phone and call her. What do you tell her?
What would I tell her? I'd say keep going and embrace whatever opportunities come towards you, as I tried to. And I'd say it'll all be okay. You know, it's a bumpy old road, but if you want it, don't let OCD stop you. I think that's what I'd say.
Yeah.
Long term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. And then, as you know, you've got a billboard. What do you want written on that billboard?
I'd probably put that the same question lies at the core of both creativity and OCD. What if? But if I've used that already, so I think it's something different.
Yeah,
the other thing that sticks out in my mind is, it's one of my doodles actually that I put down because it really resonated with me. I'd have a line drawn on it with a dot in the centre of the line, and the dot in the centre of the line is now. and anything to the right of that line is the future. Sorry, dot is the future. Anything to the left is the past. And it's something John Hirschfield said actually in his book, is that OCD thrives in the past and in the future, but it can't survive in the now. So I'd probably have a doodle on that billboard. And that's the explanation for it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I like that. That's I haven't heard that one from Sean. Yeah. Okay, look, it's all been fantastic. Is there anything else that you wish you could have shared today?
I have another experience down here, but it's a bit dark, and I don't know if I want to end on a dark dark note. But you know, I have been to the point where I have had suicidal thoughts. I've been stuck in my room because I've been frightened I'm going to throw myself off a bridge, and they were intrusive thoughts, but I couldn't tell the difference. Yeah. You know, I've been there, and I get a lot of women contacting me saying I'm terrified to have children, and I can't have all this, I've got OCD. And if I could say anything, it's that with the correct treatment and the self-help and being in this community and taking, you know, soaking all that up, you can. I think is all that I'd like to share, is that, yeah, being a mum with OCD is hard, but there is a lot of support now.
Excellent. Well, look, thank you so much for sharing, for being vulnerable, and it's been a pleasure to hear your story.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great. And it's something that I'd, you know, my mind had told me to cancel every day since we booked it, but I'm really glad that I didn't listen to that voice that said, don't do it, Laura. Yeah, so thanks for having me, Stu.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. For more information, please click the link in the episode description. A quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.